that there was no service which was more potent. The awesome worship, the Day of Atonement. It was only on Yom Kippur that the high priest vested himself in his marvelous robes of gold and personally performed the intricate ritual of the day-long sacrifice. It was only on the day of Yom Kippur that the high priest dared to ascend to the chamber of the Holy of Holies, where with a carefully studied precision, he offered the formula of confession. Anna Adonai Kaperna, forgive, I beseech thee, the sins of this people. The sanctity of the day, of the place, of the ritual, and of his person reassured Israel that their prayers had been received and that their atonement had been granted. And then in the year 70 of the Common Era, tragedy struck. After a desperate rebellion, Judea was crushed under the iron boot of the Roman legions, and the pride of Israel, the sanctuary, was razed to the ground. Not a stone remained standing on another stone. All the rituals, of course, abruptly halted. Now, if the high priest could no longer perform the ceremony of atonement, what could take its place? To abandon the Yom Kippur was unthinkable. No day was more hallowed, none so redolent in sacred memory. None bore a more urgent truth than the need to realign one's life with the law of God. What was to take its place? Fortunately, these rabbis of the first century were heirs of a tradition which had long since had an uneasy arm's-length truce with the pomp and the circumstance of the temple. The synagogue had already been devised, priestless, without sacrifice. And as motto in the synagogue, phrase from the prophet Hosea stood forth, take ye with ye words and return unto the Lord your God. Here was the way, take with ye words and return unto the Lord your God. Let each man enter the synagogue on the Yom Kippur, on the Day of Atonement, and make his own personal statement of confession and privately Lord God, for forgiveness. And the confession which we spoke this morning, which we spoke again last night, and will speak again this afternoon, reaches back across the centuries to those men at that time. Our God, God of our fathers, may our prayers come before thee. Turn not away from our supplications, for we are not so presumptuous and stiff-necked as to say before thee that we are wholly righteous and have not sinned. Verily, we have sinned. We have sinned. We have transgressed. We have done perversely. Rabbis renewed the original intent of the Yom Kippur, its biblical mandate. It was to have been a fast day. It was to have been a day for the afflicting of the soul. It was to have been a day on which man purged himself of the dross of living, cleansed himself of his sins, restructured his life on a sounder and more wholesome foundation. The rabbis reached back to that teaching which we read this morning from the unknown prophet of the exile. Is this the fast for which I have asked? the day for a man to afflict his soul? Is it for him to bow down his head as the bulrush and to scatter sackcloth and ashes under him? But the answer is no. This is the fast that I have chosen, to unloose the fetters of wickedness, to break open every band, to let the oppressed go free, to deal thy bread to the poor, to bring into thy house all those who are cast out. The spirit of Yom Kippur was to be one of search, one of confession, one of admission, one of remorse. For only when there was admission, only when there was remorse, could there be confession to God, could there be atonement. I have always respected the carefully chosen language symbol with which the rabbis reassured that desperate and confused generation. And although the temple was no more, Yom Kippur was very much alive. The Talmud puts it this way: Af al pi sha'arei avodah ninalu, sha'arei dim'ah lo ninalu. Even though the gates of ritual have been locked shut now that the temple has been destroyed, the gates of tears remain open. Now, if they had said only, the gates of ritual have been shut, the gates of worship remain open, the simple men and women of that day might have believed that the magical efficacy which they had associated with the words and the actions of the high priest had been taken over by the words and the confession of the prayer book. But no, the gates of tears remain open. Only that confession which is of the heart, which rings from us an admission, which we sense the wellspring of remorse. For what, after all, is a spoken confession, spoken with every attention to its sonorities, but with none to its damning implications? It is nothing but hollow language, an empty, vain, meaningless exercise. Rabbis renewed the human, the basic thrust of Yom Kippur. This was to be the day in which we, each of us, privately, contritely, but with desperate honesty, revealed our fumblings and our failings to God and pleaded with God for strength, for forgiveness. The gates of tears are open. The gate of tears is the symbol of the honesty of our involvement in the words of this prayer book. The gates of tears are open. I cherish, as I have said, this symbol. I cherish it for many reasons, not the least of which is that it reminds me constantly that there is a moat before my eyes. And the rabbis were not masters of the science which we call psychology. They had not yet heard of the words which we have coined, defense mechanism, ego protective syndrome, which describe that intricate maze of defenses in depth by which we deny and blind ourselves to unwelcome truth. And yet the rabbis were shrewd, keen observers of men. And they knew well that we would seek to develop every rationalization, every genteel justification For what remains when all is said and done? Evil and wrong and sin. And so when they set out to lead us to the gate of tears, they chose a language which was harsh and jolting. And not once, not twice, but hourly during this day of Yom Kippur, they made us stand up and say, "For I am not so presumptuous and stiff-necked as to say before thee that I have not sinned, that I am wholly righteous. Verily I have sinned." Many balk. Almost every rabbi has the experience after almost every Yom Kippur of someone in the congregation coming to him and saying, "Why cannot the confessional be written in more delicate and gentle language? I am not a criminal. I have not sinned." I wonder, have we not all sinned? Cannot these harsh, jolting words, sin, transgression, perversity, shock us out of our self-complacency, reach through to that almost impregnable fortress which is our self-respect, and bring us to our knees before God? The gate of tears, the gate of admission. You there. You who are hard-driving, calculating, you who pride yourself on being a man of the world, can you not shed a tear for that bright-eyed, open-hearted youngster, full of charm, full of friendliness, in whose body you once lived? A tear. A single tear. And you there. You who complain so bitterly about your lot and who lean so heavily against the love of your family and the loyalty of your friends, can you not shed a tear for those clear, inventive, eager eyes with which you once looked out at this world, and for that boyish thrill which coursed through your body with each dawn's awakening? Single admission. And mother, burdened and distraught with your household routines, feeling crimped in from your leisure by the burdens of your home, not a tear. Not a tear for that little girl who cradled her doll in her arms and in her innocent philosophy knew that there was no pleasure more satisfying and the sharing of love. You there who measure your charity by an accountant's percentage, not a tear, not a tear for the little boy who brought his most precious toy to school for the poor children. Sin. The word is harsh. It was meant to be. Who of us is so stiff-necked, presumptuous, self-involved that he cannot see that he is, after all, a sinner? There we stood. Love joined at God's altar. What useless urgency pulled us in separate ways and made us trample those tender blossoms of love? Was the forgetting not a sin? How warm and how close we felt around our parents' family table. Not a tear for those long forgotten quarrels and bitter words which turned child against child. Was it not a sin to condemn our parents to a lonely aging? Oh, how we thrilled to the newborn. Here was our joy. Here was our immortality. not a tear for those headlong preoccupations which gave us no leisure to listen to his pratlings? Was it not a sin never to have knit the ties of speech in a perfection? Who among us is so stiff-necked and so presumptuous to say that he is wholly righteous and has not sinned? Verily, we have sinned. We have transgressed. We have done perversely. What were these needless quarrels but sins? What were these bitter, angry words but sins? What were these overarching ambitions but sins? What was that niggardliness but a sin? What was that vanity, that pomposity but sin? The gates of tears. These alone can lead us to God. A humble overture. A word of confession, a beseeching of pardon, a careful new discipline. These alone can make us at one again with man. But how grateful we must be that the gates of tears remain open, that there is the possibility of at-one-ment with God and with man. You know, it's strange that the rabbi should have chosen this metaphor of the gates of sins, gates of tears. Tears come so easily, so naturally. The child cries spontaneously. He does not need a 24-hour day of involved liturgy and magnificent music to bring him to tears. He cries instinctively. Overwhelmed by joy or by shame or by sorrow, but tears are close always. But you know, if we are honest with ourselves, as we must be after all in such a day as this, can we not see that almost from his birth we enter into a conspiracy to harden his heart and to blunt his sympathies? He leads home a mangy dog, whimpering for love. We have not a look for the pleasure of his face. We see only the burden of this unrewarding sympathy. And without another word, we order the dog out of the house. The child delights in play. And so we organize his play into competition so that he may learn early the cruelty of winning and how to keep a stiff lower lip in loss. He tells us of a newfound school friend in whose company he takes delight. But this youngster comes from the other side of the racial track, and so when we have the child's party, we invite only the white parented children. Why do we enter this conspiracy against our children's feelings? Is it because their tears somehow unstick the adhesive which holds together that pathetically artificial house of cards which is our worldly, ruthless wisdom? Is it because his tears for a wounded animal shames the cold-eyed way in which we read the daily headlines of bitter cold and bitter poverty? I wonder. Why do we say that we enter a conspiracy to harden our children's hearts? Because we say that the tender-hearted never get to the top of the heap, that sympathy in the harsh, cruel world is a cul-de-sac, a detour, a dead end that a child must avoid if he wants to make his way. Just last week, I read in the newspapers a real-life morality play. The little town of Schoharie, New York, last spring, a high school junior was awarded by one of the local service clubs a citizenship medal for excellence in scholarship, in service, and in sport. Over the summer, it became known that the youngster had become a pacifist. He had decided that war was an abomination in the sight of God. He had decided that he was going to dedicate his life to the healing of the bruises of men. The service club took back the citizenship medal. And his father, who was a teacher in the high school, had this to say: "I'm really delighted that it happened. It's about time that he learned what it takes to get along in this world." What does it take? A hollow man somehow succeeding in the world of getting ahead and following after? A dulling, dampening, denying of every instinct? Is that what getting along involves? Oh yes, I know. No one has ever gotten rich or will ever get rich in the Peace Corps, but I know this too, that no one who has climbed to the top of the greasy pole has ever been able to exchange a heap of coin for happiness. They that sow in tears shall reap in joy. So it is written in our Bible. Joyousness, happiness, serenity comes only after a life with men and among men. A life in which we share their joys and their suffering. A life in which we have a vision, a horizon beyond our narrow ambition. They that sow in tears shall reap in joy. They that sow without tears, they may reap in coin. They may reap in fame. They may reap headlines. They may reap notoriety. Do they reap serenity? Are they one with God? Are they happy with themselves? Have they friendships, or only those who are sycophants, hangers-on? Do they know the warmth of love, the tenderness of sharing? They that sow in tears shall reap in joy. Child passes easily through the gate of tears. Yom Kippur is easy for our children. It is hard for us. The child cries naturally, and perhaps there we have the whole secret of this day. Be yourself. Every Jew used to pray every morning, "The soul which thou, O God, hast given unto me came pure from thee." Somehow there was a wholesomeness, a soundness, an outgoing, a sympathy, a warmth, a friendliness, a charm, which has been lost. Lost because we became hard-bitten, ruthlessly efficient, driving for what? For fame, perhaps, but not for ourselves. Be yourself. Find yourself again. Shed a tear this day for the man, the woman that you might have been. That tear is your ticket to atonement. To the price of atonement is a single tear.